From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM later on tonight. And I normally don't do this, but here's a warning. You may not want to listen as we talk about Satan's Bible. Folks, I'm not endorsing this by any means. Far from it. But we will be talking with a Satanist tonight. Here's an update on our producer, Tom Danheiser, who's been in the hospital a couple days with a pulmonary embolism. You know, we do a lot of flying, and we've been flying a lot this year, and it's very possible that's how this happened to Tom. Some kind of a clot that broke loose from his leg, perhaps. Lack of circulation when you're sitting on a plane made its way up into his lung area. And I got to tell you, it was pretty serious and pretty dangerous. And thank God Tom went to the emergency room of the hospital. He's in the hospital now still, where they've been working on him, attempting to dissolve this clot that is in his lung. But Tom sent me a text tonight, and I want to read it to you. I am overwhelmed from the support I have been getting. I thank everyone so much for their prayers and good wishes. So thank you so much for all of that. As a matter of fact, even tonight, Art Bell, doing his internet-based show, had some very sobering words for Tom's condition. And Tom appreciates that, too. Here's what's happening. A warning that the constitutional rights of tens of millions of Americans are being violated. According to a federal judge, that he's eager to expedite now a lawsuit seeking to shut down the National Security Agency's very controversial program to collect data on large volumes of U.S. telephone calls, maybe your calls. Now listen to this. Several of the most popular internet-based connected baby monitors lack basic security features, making them vulnerable to even the most basic hacking attempts, according to a new report from a cybersecurity firm. The possibility of an unknown person watching your baby's every move is kind of frightening. It's a frightening thought for many parents who have come to rely on these devices to keep an eye on their little ones. In addition, a hacked camera could provide access to other Wi-Fi-enabled devices in a person's home, such as a personal computer or security system. Lauren Weinstein, who not only watches the internet for all of us, he's an expert on this too. This is a scary story. Somebody can hack into the baby monitor, Lauren?
Yeah, I did want to say first, I want to send my best wishes to Tom. We talk all the time.
Thank you.
And I'm sure they're doing, you know, they're going to do him a good job there at the hospital, but boy, it's scary.
I've known it's scary, and he thinks the world of you.
And you've really got to deal with it, right?
Yes.
All right, baby monitors. We've talked about this a couple of times in the past, and it just seems the situation doesn't get any better. There's two points here. One is that realistically, there really haven't been any cases that I'm aware of this vulnerability being more than scary. I mean, it is really scary. But, you know, a distant person looking into a camera from 1,000 miles away or something isn't likely to be able to do anything except scare you, which is bad enough. I don't know of any cases where anybody leveraged that kind of security flaw into really doing something actually bad or causing physical harm. That said, it's really important that when you get these devices and you use these devices, and when you're researching them to find out, you know, when you go on the net before you buy something and find out about the different models and makes,
mm-hmm.
and such, to really secure them properly. Some of these are just flawed and should be pulled from the market. Others, it's really up to the people who buy them to change the default passwords. That's like the most important thing at all. If they send it out with a standard password and a hacker knows that, well, you know, you've sort of let yourself in for it. So change those passwords. Do the security things. It's a hassle, but you'll save yourself a lot of grief and perhaps some fear. And these are great devices, but we have to take responsibility for how we use them.
Well, Lauren,
it's like so many of these things in our lives now.
How does a hacker even know, though, that some home has a baby monitor?
What they do is they scan known ports and things. Most of these devices, they're mass manufactured, of course. They're in known places. They're at known addresses. They use known protocols, and so people set up these software programs that just run out there, and they scan thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of addresses, and maybe more. And they get enough hits to keep them busy. Remember, you're mostly dealing with perverts. I mean,
you're right.
Sick people with sick minds who have nothing better to do than to try to attach to a baby monitor and try to scare the parents. So they sit around, you know, in their basements doing this kind of thing rather than useful work. And they have plenty of time on their hands. That's how they do it.
Too much time.
So if you change the passwords, if you take the basic security precautions, that'll go a long way to stop them.
All right. Thanks, Lon. Appreciate that. I mean, that is scary. It really is. Law enforcement officers are resuming the intensive hunt for three suspects in the fatal shooting of a very popular veteran police officer in a small northern Illinois community. Authorities from across the state and region poured into the village of Fox Lake to join the manhunt following the death Tuesday of the officer. Wall Street stocks jumping almost 2% in the latest volatile session as investors are weighing the impact of a stumbling Chinese economy and global market turmoil on the Federal Reserve's impending decision about when to raise interest rates. Let's check in with the author of Thieves in the Temple, Andre Aglishan. Andre, when does this bust loose? They say it's going to be this month.
Well, I'll tell you, George, you're absolutely right. The markets are very jittery over what's happening in the Asian markets and China's economy particularly. And they're jittery over what the Federal Reserve is going to do. You know, the Fed has announced that by the end of the year, they expect to be able to raise interest rates. But what we're seeing is a correction that has taken place approximately about every 4 years. In 2009, the last one was in 2007, and now again in 2015. Corporate earnings are up. That's a good deal, I mean, if you're in these markets. But when you look at the volatility index and virtually every other index that measures volatility in the equities market, it's been off the Richter scale. It's up 150% on the VIX. So as I said, I believe last time I was on, September being a historically volatile month for Wall Street, I think we can expect that volatility to continue on through September.
Okay, I think you're right. Right through in October, who knows? A Disney star of the 1960s, Dean Jones, has died of Parkinson's disease. He was 84. Jones' boyish good looks and all-American manner made him Disney's favorite young actor for such lighthearted films such as That Darn Cat and The Love Bug. He passed away September 1st in Los Angeles. The death toll now from the Legionnaire's disease outbreak at a Western Illinois veterans home has climbed to 7. The state's public health director has warned that more fatalities could occur. And, of course, this has happened in New York as well. Gary Ridenour, the doctor who's an expert on pandemics. What causes all this, Gary?
Well, first off, there are 8,000 to 18,000 cases of Legionnaires per year in the United States. And these people who are infected are elderly, they have diabetes, they have heart disease, and the big thing is probably their air conditioning system has not been cleaned in 20 years and has got green slime inside of it, and that's where the our little bacteria likes to live, and it gets blown out in a very fine mist, and you inhale it, and you develop the pneumonia. A big point I'd like to make is that it's not from drinking water, and you cannot pass it from person to person. It's in San Quentin prison right now, and San Quentin has no idea what they're doing. They're feeding the inmates peanut butter and jelly sandwiches three times a day and bring trucking water in.
Jeez.
And I just said you can't get it from drinking water, and because they're afraid to cook because they think that water vapor from cooking, which is very, very hot, is going to float out and contaminate more people. And they're just lost, and I wouldn't want to be in San Quentin eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for 3 days.
I wouldn't even want to be in San Quentin, period.
Very good point, very good point. But the thing of it is that it's from dirty water containers. A bird usually carries the bacteria and drops it into a dirty cooling tower, a creek, hot water taps, evaporated coolers, large air conditioning systems, hot tubs, fountains, humidifiers, swamp coolers, windshield washer bags, bird baths, and anything else where they're standing in dirty water.
I was just talking to Dr. Miller yesterday on the program about these microbes that are everywhere. I mean, it is kind of scary. In South Florida, many people looking up just after 6 a.m. Wednesday caught a glimpse of some very strange lights. They whipped out their phones, posted pictures and video to Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Turned out to be an Atlas V rocket launched from Cape Canaveral. It's a 21-story rocket, huge, delivering a Navy satellite into orbit. Guess how many trees there are on good old planet Earth? Trees. They're estimating them to be 3 trillion trees on the planet. That figure is 8 times as big as the previous best estimate, which counted about 400 billion. 3 trillion trees. Up next, dark winter, how the sun is causing a 30-year cold spell. John Casey joins us to talk about just what the heck is going on with this weather next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. It's been almost a year. John Casey back with us. Dark winter. He's a former White House space program advisor, consultant to NASA's, of course, a space shuttle engineer. He was one of America's most successful climate change researchers and climate prediction experts. Mr. Casey is a leading advocate here in the United States for a national and international plan to prepare for the next climate change, to one of a dangerous cold climate era. This new cold era is caused by, he believes, a historic decline in the sun's energy output, what he calls a solar hibernation. John, welcome back. Good to have you.
George, good to be with you, sir.
I also can't think of a better time than to have you back because, man, this weather is weird. I mean, they're blaming this El Nino as the possibility, but something strange going on. I mean, it is getting colder. I mean, they talk about climate change and the warming, but what's happening?
Well, we are, in fact, living through a very historic period where the sun has begun a shutdown process, what we call a solar hibernation. It does occur every 206 years, where it ends the global warming it has been producing, and by cutting back on its energy output, ends up making the Earth very cold. So we're actually living through one of the most historic climate changes in human history.
This climate era change, which you say happens every 200 some years, is it dramatic?
Short answer is yes. The buildup process, almost 200 years long, where the warming takes place, is, of course, very long. But when the cold phase begins in earnest, it actually happens relatively fast. Now, as you know, and your listeners probably know, we've really had no global warming for 18 years. Despite what we hear from the president and the mainstream media and the United Nations, global warming actually ended quite some time ago, many years ago. And so we've been at this plateau by some measurements and a slight cooling by other measurements. But we're now at the precipice. We're about to fall off a global temperature cliff, all in a very predictable, scheduled manner, using solar cycles as our guideline.
Let's talk a little bit about what the president's doing, since that's in the news right now. Also, you know, in Alaska, touring, recommending changing Mount McKinley's name to Denali. What's that all about? that's a real story.
Well, there are probably more important things that the president should be worrying about.
You would think so, yeah.
The story is that the president has been up there a couple, 3 days, doing a number of drum-beating photo ops to push his climate action plan and to garner support for an upcoming very important international climate conference in Paris, France, late November, first week in December. He's doing that by pointing out problems with sea level rise. In Alaska, how one particular village is under stress from sea level rise. He's up there changing the name of Mount McKinley to Mount Denali, because this process for the name change has actually been battered around since 1975 or so. I honestly believe this is nothing more than a thumb in the eye of the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, because he's from Ohio. And I see little other reason for him doing this. First off, we have to understand the name Mount McKinley was enacted by congressional action. That's a law. And the president has basically ignored the law once again, and by executive action has changed the name. So there's really not a lot there except politics, in my opinion. His story about using Alaska, however, as a base to talk about sea level rise is really a puzzle given what's happening with the sea levels around Alaska.
Well, that's true. And let's talk about sea levels in general, John. Where do some of these people get the idea that sea levels can rise 20 feet and literally obliterate the coasts?
Well, of course, much of that has come out of the Inconvenient Truth and work by Al Gore years ago, where he famously had some researchers put together a chart of Florida covered with 21 feet of increased sea level. And that chart became almost as famous as the fraudulent hockey stick chart that was used in the UN climate reports, something put together by Dr. Michael Mann and other cohorts. Also an error, a significant error, in trying to show what climate variation has been over the last 1,000 years. So more of the same, unfortunately, George. Not a lot of it based on good science.
Are we getting any rising levels at all, John? And if we are, where's it coming from?
Well, short answer is yes. The end of global warming, because we're still at the plateau of the warmth before the drop-off into the cold, we are still seeing a cumulative increase worldwide in sea levels. However, it's very important to note that, like most things around the Earth, it's not monolithic. We're already seeing ocean temperatures drop in various locations. Sea levels start to drop, especially in Alaska.
Could we experience more droughts around this planet like we have in California?
Short answer is yes. The drought cycle in California is very similar to drought cycles around the world, all, in my opinion, driven primarily by natural events, natural cycles. California has an 11 to 13 year drought cycle. There is another major 60 year drought cycle that affects nations around the world. And, you know, this is just something we need to educate our people on, educate our students on, that these natural cycles drive climate, they drive droughts, they drive monsoons, floods, all of these natural weather events that become extreme do so quite often on a periodic, predictable basis.
And when it happens, as you mentioned, extreme, they are extreme. They seem that these storms, whether they're tornadoes or hurricanes or tropical storms, they all seem to be bigger and more intense, don't they?
Yes, they do, and that's not unexpected. When we are experiencing a transition period from the past warm period to a new cold climate, what we're going to see is more pronounced battle lines being drawn up, if you will, between the warm fronts coming up from the equator meeting the cold fronts coming down from the north. We saw this in spades, of course, in the winter, and how it devastated the northeastern U.S. With extreme cold. These extreme weather events are quite typical, I believe, of the transition from a major cold or warm cycle.
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back with John Casey as we talk about what the heck is happening to this planet. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls as well. Many of you interested in this situation. Up next, we're going to talk about the meeting coming up in Paris in November. Wow. What are they going to talk about? John Casey with us. And of course, we'll take calls with him next hour as we talk about what's happening with the climate. I'm sure you have many stories and questions about that as well. Welcome back to Coast. Now, the world's leaders will gather in Paris late November through the first week of December this year for its next conference of parties. It's called COP, to try to arrive at some international consensus on what to do about what they call greenhouse gas emissions. John, they're not going to give up, are they?
No, they are not, George. They are tenacious, if nothing else.
Now, what is their definition of greenhouse gas emissions, anyway?
Well, they have narrowed it down. It was previously everything under the sun labeled as small trace gases, but most of the work now is focused strictly on the industrial CO2 output by mankind and attempts to limit that alone. Natural CO2, which is 20 times greater than industrial CO2 produced by mankind, of course, we have no control over that whatsoever, so they can't regulate that. So they're trying to narrow it down to emission controls over CO2 produced by mankind. And they hope to come to some kind of, at least a voluntary consensus agreement in Paris in December.
Are they doing it, John, because they really think they're going to save the planet, or is there some greed factor here?
Well, it's really all about the money and power. To be quite honest, George, it was never about the science when the global warming movement began back in the mid-80s. It was always about imposing a form of socialism throughout the world and redistribution of wealth. That's from the words of those who actually began the effort and are currently leading it at the UN. It's really about moving money from the developed nations to the undeveloped. It's all about imposing controls over people's property, their way of life, mm-hmm. what kind of vehicles they drive, whether they can have access to natural water like lakes or ponds or streams or the ocean. It's really a future that is almost Orwellian if you allow the UN and the current Obama administration to impose the kind of controls they're talking about.
John, why is this such an emotional topic? I'm sure when we open up the phone lines next hour, we're going to get lots of folks who agree with you and some people who don't. But it becomes so emotional where people scream at each other over this topic. How come?
Oh, absolutely, George. And this is not unusual. My family, every family, you'll find people who get quite emotional over this climate matter and saving the planet and environmentalism. And really, that's what's happened. The generations that are currently on this planet now are the most educated and most sensitive about the environmental issue in the history of the human species. We've never been more conscious and more aware and more eager to do something to preserve our environment. That good thing, that good sense, that good goal that everyone has about the environment, unfortunately, was taken advantage of by the politicians, those who wanted to gain power. And so they've twisted that very necessary environmental attitude into something that has polarized people, that has divided families, divided friends, and unfortunately that's one of the ill effects of a program that is deceptive at the start.
So as we look at where we're headed, I mean, many of us do not want pollution, but isn't there a big distinctive difference between pollution and climate change?
Very key point. And the people who are pushing the global warming movement and plans like the president's Climate Action Plan and the United Nations plans coming up in December are all using that tool and confusing the public. Certainly we have pollution problems, no question about it. Even in my neighborhood, I had to assemble a group of organizations to fight for clean water in our lakes and our streams. That's pollution. It is not climate. Climate affects the entire world and is driven by the sun and our position as we revolve around the sun, but it is not a mankind-driven thing. Mankind does pollute, but mankind does not change the climate.
John, lately a lot of people, seismologists in particular, are talking about the big one that could hit the West Coast in St. Louis, where I spend a lot of time. You know, it's by the New Madrid Fault. That could be even bigger, I think, than the San Andreas Fault on the West Coast. Your thoughts on earthquakes and fracking?
Well, earthquakes and fracking, there's a very strong correlation. I think the science is pretty solid there. It shows that, especially in Oklahoma, some instances in Ohio and elsewhere, everywhere we've seen an increase in the use of the fracking technology to extract oil and gas, we've also seen fairly dramatic increase in minor to moderate sized earthquakes. We're talking 2 to 4.0, 4.5 perhaps magnitude. These do not bring buildings down. They shudder. They might knock off the shelf and scare the dogs and whatnot, but they don't really kill people. That's the fracking earthquakes. However, what we have talked about in my past company, the Space and Science Research Corporation, we had a global climate status report, and in the final report, we had very specific, very detailed research results that showed a very high probability of a catastrophic quake on the West Coast, in the New Madrid Fault Zone, and possibly even in the South Carolina Fault Zone.
Is that coming? Is that based on historical data, or do we know something here?
We know a lot more than we used to. What we do know, tied to climate change, is that when these cold climate eras begin and then reach a bottom cold era cycle, we see our worst ever earthquakes and our worst volcanic eruptions all at the same time. Now, the mechanism for why that happens, we don't know. It's a global cooling kind of effect, and there's no money for global cooling. Of course, there's billions for global warming studies, but nothing for analyzing this kind of a collateral effect. However, let's look at the New Madrid fault there south of St. Louis, between St. Louis and Memphis.
They had an earthquake that turned the Mississippi around.
Yes, they did. That was from 1811 to 1812. Three catastrophic earthquakes within just a few months of each other struck that region. The typical calculation showed 7, 7.5, 8.0. Any one of those would be a devastating quake if it hit today. Of course, back then there was hardly anyone there. Some trader posts, some Native American villages and so forth. We were a very young country. We only had 5 million citizens back then. But right now we've got millions of people living there now. Our research is very strong. It shows that every time these solar hibernations, these cold eras strike, we have had a major earthquake hit the New Madrid Fault for the last, since the year 1400.
Every time?
Now that a new one is coming, we should expect a major quake.
Every time?
Every time since the year 1400 that we have had a solar hibernation, we've had a catastrophic earthquake hit that New Madrid Fault.
And the correlation is what, John?
Well, 4 out of 4 have struck during the last 4 solar hibernations. Now that the 5th solar hibernation is coming, well, let me put it to you this way. If you were told and read in the paper that at a particular intersection near your home, there was a catastrophic accident 4 years in a row the first week in December. And here it is the fifth December, fifth year, you're approaching the same intersection. Are you going through that intersection if it's the first week in December? Probably not.
Probably not. I may show up just because I'm curious, but I'm not going through it.
Right. Well, that's what we're looking at. The last four major catastrophic quakes all occurred at the solar hibernation. And now we've got a new solar hibernation coming. Everyone in that community should be very, very concerned and preparing. Unfortunately, our government is not doing so.
Now, you say the solar hibernation comes every 200 years, but how long does it last?
The period ranges from about 20 to 30 years. Now, that's the standard 206-year cold era. However, I have to add that in our last global climate report, we've been very consistent on this, that it could be as bad as it was back in 1811, 1812, or it could be as bad as the Little Ice Age. And there's now new research coming out worldwide showing that it's quite possible that a little ice age will descend upon us here in the next 20 to 30 years.
Into this 20-year cycle, when does those earthquakes occur? Is there any specific time period? Is it like 5 years into it, 2 years
Actually,
into it?
Actually, it's fairly close to the bottom of the cold cycle. So that's something we can calculate. We issued a press release that said that the highest, most dangerous window of opportunity is going to be from 2017 to 2038. Now, that's for the entire U.S. West Coast, for the central Mississippi Valley, and for South Carolina.
So there's a window there. There's a window there.
There is a window. There's even a more specific window within that window. But this gives us a little time, not much. But again, my concern here is that our government is quite aware of these facts, and they're really doing very little to get prepared for a major catastrophic quake. Again, four out of four times it has struck during these cold eras, and now a new cold era is coming. We should assume it's going to hit again.
What do you think they can do? Because they can't move millions of people. They can't, move them to different cities and get them employed. So what does government do? What can they
do? Well, there's a lot they can do that they aren't doing. The number one is to educate the people, and they are simply not doing that. Even the U.S. Geological Survey, which has upped its threat level for that area and California, they've only done so by a few percentage points. We're talking about a very high probability here, not just a few percentage points increased threat level. What they can do is first educate the people, let them know about how these things hit and when they hit and what the likelihood is, and then take a lot more concrete steps to prepare the people. Let me give you an example.
All right.
There is something that the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is doing in concert with the USGS. It's called a Great Shakeout, and it is a preparatory process they go through, basically having people pick a date or a week in their state and pretend that there's a earthquake coming. They have all the kids at the school get under their desk, that kind of thing.
We went through that in the 60s, did we?
Yeah, we did so preparing for a nuclear strike from the Soviet Union back then. Similar thing. We need a similar kind of U.S.-wide preparation program. We just don't have that happening. Even the program I just mentioned, the shakeout program, that's voluntary. This is a very serious matter. Our government is not taking it serious.
Are there telltale signs that these earthquakes are occurring or getting close? Will we see more smaller earthquakes leading up to the big one?
Typically we do. That's the good news. Unfortunately, We have very little history in the New Madrid area, and there were no recordings, no scientific data being collected back then in that area. And even the reports we do have from that area did not indicate a lot of major foreshocks. It looked like for the New Madrid area that we went right into the major 7.0 plus quake series back in 1811, 1812, without a lot of warning. Out in California, different situation. We've got different tectonic dynamics there than we do in the central Mississippi Valley. We do get typically a lot of foreshocks out in California and other indicators. Our International Earthquake and Volcano Prediction team of scientists has come up with, in fact, 10 or 12 precursor signals that they look at to determine whether an earthquake is coming, not just the history of the quakes in a particular region.
The Yellowstone Caldera, have you looked at that region, John?
I have. Our team has not, and the reason we have not is a super volcano like the Yellowstone is probably the most heavily monitored and supervised super volcanoes on the planet. It is not, however, in my opinion, the most dangerous super volcano we have. And unfortunately, those are not being monitored hardly at all.
Where's the other one that you think could be even worse?
Well, there are five or six worldwide. The most dangerous ones are in New Zealand and in Indonesia. The ones in those locations have erupted in the past. And in fact, the one in Indonesia that erupted almost wiped out all of humanity about 74,000 years ago. There were only a few thousand people left after that eruption. And that was a global devastating eruption, much like the comet or asteroid that took out the dinosaurs, except this was a volcano.
The Canary Islands have the potential also for a huge tsunami, right?
Yes, they do. Dr. Simon Day has been widely seen on TV and a lot of our programs, both Discovery and History Channel and so forth, talking about the threat of the La Cumbre Vieja volcano on the island of La Palma. That is a very interesting situation. He has shown that there is a physical crack through that volcano. If it does erupt again, it could in fact cause much of that island, which is a fairly sizable island, to slide into the ocean. That could create a tsunami that would take out many of the cities along the U.S. East Coast.
I've heard almost 50 miles inland it would take. That sounds horrible.
Well, that's probably not what Dr. Day would agree with, but that would be an extreme case. It might happen in Florida where it's essentially flat, but up north Atlantic along the U.S. coast where you get steeper elevations, you probably wouldn't see
but
that.
Manhattan
would go in a few miles or so.
Manhattan would be wiped out.
We're talking about a potentially 100-foot tsunami.
With an incredible force.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Could it knock down a skyscraper?
If it's in the Miami area, it potentially could. If it's a moderate construction with earthquake standards, maybe not. But it would certainly kill everyone in that immediate area.
Scary. John, stay with us. We're going to come back at the top of the hour and take some phone calls with you, questions, stories as well. I agree with you. I think something big is happening, and a lot of people are feeling these strange things. Let's hope it's many, many, many years away. John Casey with us, his book, Dark Winter, How the Sun is Causing a 30-Year Cold Spell. And don't forget, Robert Felix, one of our guests, believe that we're in the beginning stages of a mini ice age as well. A lot of people ridicule him for that, but you know what? He could be right.